Broadcasting from New York City to the world, it's the G-Man Interviews.
Welcome. Following excerpt is from a May 2024 Daily Kos article entitled The Political Manipulation of White Grievance. Right-wing money, institutes, and foundations are behind the political manipulation of white grievance about the transformation of American society, stirring up and exploiting covert and overt racism. It funds campaigns challenging affirmative action as anti-white, even though the largest beneficiary of affirmative action has been white women, and as a result, the income of white families. In an essay for the Chronicle of Higher Education, Stephen Brent, a professor of sociology and public policy at the University of California at Riverside, documented the right-wing forces behind efforts to suppress academic freedom in American schools and the war on mythologized critical race theory and the teaching of supposedly divisive concepts. Brent accuses the political right of perverting the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, passed after the Civil War to protect the rights of newly freed African Americans, as a vehicle to protect white people from efforts to rectify racial inequality in the United States. Brent found that in 2021, Republican-controlled state legislatures began proposing almost identical legislation, banning what they claimed was the teaching of divisive concepts in public schools and universities and the promotion of racial and ethnic diversity in hiring. Brent believes the war against critical race theory and diversity, equity, and inclusion was a response to the protest movement following the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. The article was written by Alan Singer, a social studies educator in the Department of Teaching, Literacy, and Technology at Hofstra University in Long Island, New York. Professor Singer has taught at a number of secondary schools in New York City, including Franklin K. Lane High School and Edward R. Murrow High School. He is the author of Education Flashpoints, Fighting for America's Schools, which is based on his award-winning Huffington Post blogs, Teaching to Learn, Learning to Teach, A Handbook for Secondary School Teachers, Social Studies for Secondary Schools, and New York and Slavery, Time to Teach the Truth. He joins me to discuss his article in greater detail and why he believes it's critical in addressing and understanding racial discord in America. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the show, Professor Singer.
All right, please call me Alan.
Okay, will do. In the opening, I gave listeners a summary of your article by sharing the first three paragraphs. Could you provide a synopsis of the entire article and explain why you felt it was important to write and publish it?
Yeah, I've been writing a blog mostly on Daily Kos now for a number of years. I recently published a book with SUNY Press called Class Conscious Coal Miners. And that's really where I'm starting. I started the book in the 1970s, where I interviewed miners who were politically active, and they were the most radical segment of the American working class in the 1920s. And one of the things that struck me as I was working on the book is that, first, these miners were continuously willing to go on strike in the 20s and 30s. In central Pennsylvania, bituminous coal miners were really the only workers to go on strike during World War II. We're talking about very militant, class-conscious workers. Today, that region of central Pennsylvania votes overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020. And it was such a striking transformation from class-conscious political activism to really right-wing voting patterns. And in 2016 and 2020, over 70% of the voters in that region voted for Donald Trump. So as I'm working on the book, I'm asking what happened to the white working class. Why does the white working class now so frequently identify and vote for the right wing? So that's where I started. Now, for this article, I came across some research that was done that looked at who was behind a lot of the efforts to fight back against Black Lives Matter, to challenge critical race theory, to outlaw essentially diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it turns out that what we're looking at is deep pocket right-wing money. Foundations like the Koch Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, they're putting up the money to defeat progressive groups and progressive issues. That's what the article is about. Who's putting up the money to essentially play on white working class grievance to get them to vote for people like Trump?
Back in December of 2023, an article appeared in the Florida Phoenix entitled Project 2025, If Allowed, Will Cement America as a Right-Wing Authoritarian State. A portion of the article, which was written by Barrington Salmon, stated, Project 2025 is a sweeping right-wing blueprint for the next Republican president, Trump or not, to run the country for the foreseeable future. Funded by the Heritage Foundation, Koch Brothers, and a vast and secretive dark money network, the project has recruited at least 80 far-right organizations and entities to the cause. In 2024, women of childbearing age, young adults, children, African Americans, undocumented immigrants, and other marginalized communities have the most to lose if Donald Trump wins a second term because he's coming for us. You mentioned the Heritage Foundation and the Koch brothers in your article. Were you aware of Project 2025? And if so, do you believe the attacks on critical race theory and diversity, equity, and inclusion are directly linked to Project 2025?
These attacks preceded Project 2025, but they are part of the same right-wing campaign. The attack on critical race theory was in many ways a response to the 1619 Project, which was developed by the New York Times and Nicole Hannah-Jones. And what happens in the 1619 Project looks back at the 400th anniversary of the introduction of the first enslaved Africans into Jamestown. So what you have is the effort to redefine what American history actually took place. And then you had the Black Lives Matter movement following the murder of George Floyd. So again, what we have are a right-wing reaction against the 1619 Project. Remember, the Trump administration came out with its own project called the 1776 Project. And, you know, so what we have are, is America founded on slavery, or is America founded on this, you know, dream of equality? Many of the people who were involved in the, as founders of the nation were also slaveholders, including George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry. And they never apologized for what they did. They never condemned it. It was necessary for their wealth and their way of life. So what we have is things like the 2025 Project were really an effort to codify the struggle against progressive politics in the United States. One of the things that I look at with critical race theory is critical race theory in legal terms develops in the 1970s, 1980s. It's brought into education issues in history, really, in the 1990s. But critical race theory has much deeper roots in the United States. You know, in schools, we often learn about Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a French visitor to the United States who wrote a book called Democracy in America. But one of the passages which we never really look at is where de Tocqueville examines race in the United States. And in 1835, de Tocqueville actually argued that there would never be racial equality in the United States because democracy for white people depended on the oppression of black people, whether as slaves or later as under Jim Crow. That understanding of race actually dates to an 1835 study. In the 1950s Dred Scott decision, Dred Scott had been enslaved. He had been taken by his so-called owner to free territory in Minnesota. He voluntarily returned south, and now he sued for his freedom, claiming that once he was in Minnesota territory, he was a free man because there was no slavery allowed there. In the Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2, seven slaveholders to two non-slaveholders, that Dred Scott was not free because under the Declaration of the Constitution, African Americans had no rights in the United States because they were not included in the concept of American, the concept of citizen. So what we have in 1857 is the Supreme Court institutionalizing critical race theory, but to oppress black people. So what we have, critical race theory, is really an effort to understand the history of the United States. I didn't agree with every claim that was made in the 1619 Project, but definitely these were claims that have to be explored in classrooms, and they should have never been banned in places like Florida.
When you look at the fact that the aforementioned right-wing groups are spearheading this all-out effort, which would you cite as their main reason for doing so? Again, which would you cite as the main reason for their doing so? Maintaining political power, maintaining the capitalist system, or maintaining white privilege and rule in America?
That's a very good question. Look, they want to maintain political power to maintain the freedom to exploit under the capitalist system. One of the things I argue is it's difficult to say any particular individual is a racist. But what we're really looking at is a system that has its roots in racism and remains in place because of racism. So we're looking at a systemic issue, not individuals. I'm not going to call any individual who I don't know a racist. I mean, David Duke is a racist. You know, one of the Koch brothers is already dead. I don't know what they're like personally. But what they are willing to do is to use legitimate white grievance in a white working class to maintain political power. Now, one of the things that has happened since the 1960s is the world of the white worker has been fundamentally transformed. The demographics of the United States radically changed after the 1965 immigration laws changed. But I think even of greater impact was globalization and the weakening of the private sector unions. Today, I think about 5% of the American working class belongs to a private sector union. I mean, we're talking about very small numbers, down from what may have been 30% at its peak. So what has happened in many working class communities, especially the white working class communities, is that the stable, well-paid union jobs that people had from the 50s, maybe into the 80s, have disappeared. What you have in central Pennsylvania is poverty, but I think it's not only is it the absence of, you know, people end up going to work for Walmart at a fraction of what they had been paid at union jobs, but for young people growing up in these regions, there's no hope for the future, so they leave. So what you have is an older population whose children and grandchildren have moved away, who are dependent on jobs at Walmart and places like that, or dependent on disability payments or Social Security. So people are looking at the country and they're saying, what happened to my country? It's somebody took it away from me. And what they end up doing is blaming the coastal elite, the liberals, the minorities, and saying, these people, you know, took my country away. So you get politicians like Trump, demagogues like Trump, with the support of these right-wing foundations that play upon the fears and the angers of these people and use it to maintain power. In 2016, Trump promised to restore coal. Trump was in office for 4 years. They never restored coal because coal is not competitive with other fuels. But voters in these regions voted Trump. West Virginia is the most right-wing voting group in the United States. They vote for Trump on the false illusion that somehow Trump and these right-wing groups will restore the world they lived in. And it's never going to happen.
If you're at liberty to do so, can you describe how the faculty and students at Hofstra have reacted to the ongoing effort to eradicate CRT and DEI programs?
Well, I have to say, at Hofstra, DEI is very strong. There's recognition of recruiting of students, diverse populations, hiring faculty. We have workshops on how we can better do these things, how we can make the university a more comfortable place. So there has not been an attack on DEI at Hofstra. As a matter of fact, Hofstra partnered with East Suffolk BOCES to deliver DEI seminars to Long Island school administrators. So again, Hofstra has a very good record on DEI. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, because one of the things that's happened is in the last election, 2022, there essentially was a Republican sweep of a lot of county offices, and the county office is very opposed to DEI, but the university has remained steadfast.
You've written extensively on the former president, so let me ask you this. What is your greatest fear about Donald Trump being elected the 47th president of the United States?
Oh, God. I have too many fears.
I imagine you do, but tell me what your greatest fear is.
Look, I'm almost 75 years old, but I have grandchildren who are, you know, in college now. I have children and grandchildren. I worry about their future. My greatest fear is the issue of climate change, and I really worry whether we have passed the tipping point where things are just going to keep getting worse and worse, and we may not be able to fix them. You know, Trump recently had a meeting with the fossil fuel industry where he said, I want $1 billion in campaign contributions, and in exchange, I will end any of the restrictions that have been put in place on fossil fuel development. Now, this was reported in the New York Times. This was not some kind of conspiracy. But just looking today at what's going on around the world, the Amazon rainforest is drying up. It's in an immense drought. Now, that rainforest, I think, has about 25% of the Earth's fresh water. Now, it has an enormous reservoir of life forms. But again, that's the Amazon River. But the Canadian forests are burning again. In New York last summer, we had a 40% rise in people going to hospitals because of asthma, and it's going to happen again and again and again. Coral reefs are dying. Hurricanes are becoming more intense. There was a really strange article that I saw. Howler monkeys are dying in the trees and falling out of the trees in Mexico because of extreme heat. Now, it might not be, you know, someone concerned about the monkey population or about the coral reefs, but in the whole line of latitude, starting in Africa with the Sahel across Asia, there have been record-setting temperatures and people have been dying in the streets. One of the things that we rarely talk about is in those regions where we have the greatest impact of climate change today, have also become war zones as people are fighting for diminishing resources. So I am very worried that a Donald Trump election is going to put a halt to even the minimal addressing of climate change. And I think that's the scariest part of a possible Trump election.
If there's anything you'd like to say in closing, please take this opportunity to do so.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to think about these things with you. I just think that this tremendous amount of crisis going on, you know, the MAGNA movement is based on a return to a fictional past that never really existed for most people. And I just think that people who are clear about what's taking place have to take an active role, writing, teaching, exploring, and organizing to help people understand the risks the country faces if there's another Trump presidency.
Again, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, Professor Singer. Thank you for taking the time to provide your assessments and insights. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
I thank you for being here as well. Until next time, stay cool, stay safe, and stay informed.